Firstly, my respects to Ajahn Brahmawangso and my greetings to all of you. It is very nice to be back once again at the Buddhist Society of WA after having been away for almost 3 years now, and to come back into your presence and see so many good and wonderful people coming together doing absolutely nothing. Sitting with their eyes shut, trying to be still, trying to still their body and trying to still their mind. And so it's nice to come together with all of you and do nothing with you, and also to have this opportunity to speak with you. And I would like to, this evening, to talk about a subject which I have been speaking on a bit in the last week or so, which is on the area of, the Pali word is papancha, which means speculation. And before I go into this realm of speculation, I want to tell a story which I mentioned to a lady today when we went to visit her in the hospital with Ajahn Brahmawangso to give her some support. And it's a story that a man told at one of our branch monasteries in America. We have a monastery in California, Hueros, which this gentleman visited and spent some time at, and he was very interested in solitary life. And he had lived in Alaska, and he told the monks that during his time in Alaska he was living the outdoor life. He wasn't a Buddhist at that time, and he was living by hunting and fishing. And one day he went out to go fishing in his canoe along the river, and he found a baby bear cub abandoned on an island in the river. He was a bit concerned that the mother would come back, but after watching for almost half a day, he noticed that it definitely had been abandoned. So he took this baby bear cub in and subsequently raised it for the next 2 years. And the baby bear subsequently ate him out of house and home, he said, because it grew very quick and they became the best of friends. And because this bear was his friend, his companion, his partner in adventures, they used to go out fishing together at their favorite fishing site, and he would teach the bear how to fish in natural ways. And after a while, the bear was getting very large and obviously maturing. Its interest started to go elsewhere and it started to wander off, possibly looking for a mate. And on one occasion, he was sitting in the cabin, and his bear had disappeared for 10 days. And he started to worry. And when he worried, he speculated. What has happened to the bear? Has it starved? Will it find enough food? Has a hunter shot it? Has some danger occurred to my pet, my loved one, my friend? And that worry turned to anxiety. And then that anxiety turned to fear, and he decided he had to do something. He couldn't sit still. He went trekking to try and find and locate his bear. And after an 8-kilometer walk back to their favorite fishing spot, he saw a black bear there fishing on the river, and he went straight up to it, and he was carrying a staff at the time, and poked the bear in the backside and said, "What are you doing here? Come on, get back to the cabin." And the bear was quite disinterested and was resistant to move, and he kept on poking it, and eventually the bear was pushed along the path, and the bear walked most of the way back to the cabin. Every now and then the bear would stop and turn around and grumble, and he'd poke the bear and say, "Come on, get back to the cabin." And as they got to the top of the ridge, he looked down on his cabin, and there on the porch was his pet bear. The bear in front of him was a completely wild bear. Then he began to speculate again about what was going to happen. Fortunately, he was quick on his feet and he survived the incident. But the interesting thing he said was that the reason he felt that the bear didn't attack him was because he loved it totally. It was his best friend. And the bear realized that. And also he had no fear for the thing he loved. And that's why the bear responded as it did. It must have been very dazed and confused what was going on, but it did go along the path. And he survived to tell the tale, and the reason I tell that story is because we see how speculation, this papancha, works in our lives. Maybe your bear hasn't come home, or you don't have a bear, but you may have children who haven't come home. And we have speculation going, the same concern. Oh, it's late. Where are they, dear? I don't know. They haven't rang yet. Their mobile phone's not turned on. They're not answering. It's getting later, and then anxiety steps in, worry, fear, and then imagination. What if? And that imagination, that speculation, that painting the picture, that fantasy of the mind is what we call papancha. Papancha is when we add on to the reality, when we paint a picture in our mental formations, in our mind, of what could be, what if, what may be. We're not experiencing what is, what's the reality, what's going on. And we see that we do that all the time, both positively, in a positive sense, we can speculate and imagine in a positive sense, and also in a negative sense, where it becomes anxieties, fears, worries, concerns, or daydreams and fantasies and imaginations. And so this is a very important subject, because if we do not realize how we're adding on, we don't catch the momentum of papancha, then we won't be able to take the mind back to the present moment and back to peace. Because the mind likes to color and add on. And this Pali word, the ancient Buddhist language of papancha, has a very nice translation in Thai. The Thai word for papancha is to prung dang. And prung dang, prung, the word prung means to flavor or spice up, add to enhance, to make more of. So you prung dang, you add and spice and flavor food. You add to a situation. And the dang means to paint, to color, to enhance, to make more of, to dress up. And so this gives us a good image of what happens in the process of the mind when we add to something. A situation, a feeling, a thought, an idea, an experience occurs, and we tend to build up on it, add more to it, color it, spice it, make more of it than it really is. The real experience is just that. For example, at the moment, there is just seeing and hearing. There's physical contact, feeling arising. There may be some smell. There's probably no taste going on. So it's just seeing. We do not have to add to the seeing. There is just sound. We do not have to add to the sound. That is what we're adding on to the process of what's going on, making more of, enhancing. And we see that. We do this all the time. I'll give you an example of a monk who did not add on. I very recently went to pay respects to a monk in Thailand. He is 109 years old and was ordained at the age of 9. He's been in the robes for 100 years. And as monks, we always bow down to the person who's been ordained longer. So obviously I bow down to him. He's probably the oldest monk in the world and a very venerable monk, and has lived a very adventurous and wonderful life. And his faculties, his mental faculties, are incredibly sharp and bright. His hearing is going a bit, and one of his eyes has gone blind, but his mind and memory is phenomenal. To the point where one of the nuns who was living with him said that whenever she would go to a hut and read a book, and she'd read a book on Ajahn Chah, and she'd get to a line in the book that she didn't understand, she would pass over it. And then in the evening, when she would go and see her teacher, this venerable monk, 109 years old, he would say, "Today you are reading this book," and tell her the title of the book. "You're reading this line," and repeat the lines, "and you didn't understand these words," and then he'd explain her the meaning. So his outer eyes were deteriorating, but his inner eyes were very sharp. And one of the stories of this monk, which highlights the idea of not adding on, not speculating, but just knowing what's going on, overcoming the anxieties and fears and worries and concerns of life, was when he was sitting meditation alone in the jungle one time. And as he had his eyes shut, this very large python came up. It was as large as his leg, and struck him on the shoulder and curled around him to suffocate him and crush him. And as he was being squeezed and he had his last breath, he said he could only just get out the words. He said to the python, "If you're going to eat me, you have to take me to enlightenment, because I'm determined to go to enlightenment in this lifetime. So if you eat me, take me to Nibbana." And at that, the snake let go and slithered away. Now just think, if you were sitting here in this meditation hall, listening to a talk by Ajahn Yanadamo, and a python struck you on the shoulder, curled around you, started squeezing every ounce of breath out of your lungs, what would you remember? Would you remember the ultimate goal in your life? Or would you remember you haven't paid your telephone bill, you haven't said goodnight to your wife or husband? Would you start speculating about what's going on? And that's an example of the clarity of mind that comes through training. That does not arise out of the ether, so to speak, or out of the past, but out of mental training, by focusing the mind on the present, by drawing the mind down to purity and peace, and stilling, calming that mind. So even when the most dangerous situation arises, then the mind can be still. Then the mind can overcome the speculation, the adding on to the situation, making much more of it than it really is, and just knowing what's going on. And the knowing and noting of what's going on, what do I know, rather than what do I think I know. That cuts through the speculation when we say, what do I know? What is known here and now? Rather than speculating what possibly will be known. So we see that actually we often add on to our experiences. That is the general tendency of the mind to spice things up, to add on, make much of, make more of the real experience that is being experienced here and now. Our adding on depends on our attitude to a situation. For example, if we're feeling very well, very positive, we can add on a positive gloss, positive speculation, and a lot of people can get lost in imagining they win the lotto and spend many hours spending that imaginary money. This is prapancha. Other people can spend many hours speculating on life in the ether on another planet. They get lost in speculation about UFOs and other wonderful imaginary things of life in space and life in the future. And other people can get lost and caught up in the negative feelings because the root cause is coming out of aversion. And they speculate about how sick they are and then how sick they're going to get. How miserable they are and how miserable they're going to get. And they imagine and speculate and add on to what's going on now, what they can know now, and make and create a whole picture. They colour their world according to that papancha, and do not recognize that this is papancha. This is colouring the reality of what's going on here and now, the experience here and now. And to give you an example of this, how we tend to think of our situation in a particular way, and to think it's our personal experience is somehow negative. We tend to think of our suffering and not realize often that there are others who have suffered much more. An example of that was maybe many of you may remember that last time I visited, I had my leg in a brace. I'd broken my ankle, and just recently my leg has improved, but I have to wear a sort of raised shoes, and I wore a walking stick for quite some time. And in January I went to a large gathering of monks, and there was another monk there who had the same type of shoes and also had a use of a walking stick. And he saw me using this walking stick, and he said, "What happened to you?" And I said, "Well, I broke my ankle falling from 2 meters." And I noticed he had similar shoes, and I said, "What happened to your ankle?" Because he had a scar on his foot ankle, the same right ankle. And he said, "I broke my ankle falling from 200 meters. I suddenly felt a lot better. And he told me this story, which was his own experience. He was on Tudong, traveling in the forests of a national park in Thailand, which is on a plateau very high up. And as he was traveling through the forest, he went to get some water. And he went to this water source, and he found a monk sitting on the ground and holding his ankle. he went over to this monk and introduced himself, and he saw that this monk was in great pain because he had a cable, a wire cable, embedded through the skin onto the bone of his ankle. He had been caught in a snare that was used for catching wild pigs. A hunter had tied an electrical cable, very strong, to a very large and flexible tree and had set up a hidden snare to catch the wild pigs that come down to this water hole. And this monk had stepped into the snare and had been flicked up into the air, dangling upside down. And the snare had broke his ankle, and the wire was caught on the bone embedded in the flesh. He was able to lower himself down and untie the end of the snare, but the snare was still on his ankle after 3 weeks. And the monk told my friend, he said, "I haven't taken the snare off because I'm waiting for the hunter to come back and I want him to take it off. He is the one who intended to kill. He is the one who intended to injure. He should undo his doing." And so he'd been waiting there for 3 weeks because he did not want this person to make further unwholesome karma. And the friend who told the story said that he wasn't sure whether to think this monk is extremely holy or extremely mad. And the monk told him that since he had ordained, he'd been ordained for 8 years, he said, "I was never able to make my mind peaceful even once. But since I've been sitting here, realizing that death can occur at any moment if that hunter doesn't arrive, my mind has fallen into deep states of peace many times. And sometimes I sit here all day free of pain because of that peace of just letting go, abandoning all thoughts about what if." And abandoning all thoughts about what if is letting go of all papancha, all speculation. And so he said, "I do not care if I die, but I don't want that pig hunter to hurt any other living being. I want him to realize the consequences of his action." And my friend, the venerable monk, asked him, "Can I help you in any way? Can I carry you down off the mountain?" And he said, "No, I'm going to wait here." He hadn't eaten for 3 weeks, but he was able to crawl for the water. And after that, the monk offered to go down as soon as dawn arrived, because it was getting evening. And as soon as dawn arose, he would go down to the village below and ask anyone in the village, do they know who set up the snare, do they know the hunter, and tell him to quickly go up the mountain and help this monk. And the monk agreed that that was a good thing to do. And so at 4 o'clock in the morning, a friend quickly packed up his things. He had a mosquito net and an umbrella, which was rolled up, and he put that across his shoulders. And he carried his bowl, and he had a candle lantern in his hands. And he was just trying to walk down off this mountain in the light of a very small candle. And he was thinking about this monk and speculating, is that the right thing to do? Should he get treatment? Is it the right thing? Is there another way of dealing with his situation. And when he was caught up in his speculation, he didn't see the edge of the cliff. And he fell over the 200-meter drop. And he noticed his candle lantern dropping out of his hand and flicking through the air. And it was a long way down. And fortunately for him, he was going down head first. But fortunately for him, there was a clump of very large, tall bamboo. And there was three of these clumps separated. And there was vines, very thick vines, between the clumps of bamboo. And he happened to go down head first between the opening of one of these vines, where it formed a V, and the umbrella that was across his shoulders caught on the vine. He broke his ribs, and then his ankle caught in another branch of the vines and was jammed in that. And as the weight of his body pulled the bamboo down, bamboo is very malleable, and it became a spring. And so he was going up and down, head first to the ground, caught in the bamboo and on the vines. He survived the fall, but he was stuck in the bamboo. And he had his foot, he was hanging upside down, his ribs were broken, his ankle was broken, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning. Time for more papancha. What will happen to me? Will I die? Will anyone come? He had 3 long hours of thinking. And then after that, 7 o'clock in the morning, an old man came along looking for things in the forest. And he called out to him. He called out for help. And of course, this old man was not expecting or looking for a monk in the trees. And he kept on calling out, "Up here." And when the old man looked up and saw him, he said, "Venerable sir, what are you doing in the trees?" And he said, "Don't ask anything, just get me down." And so there was a long procedure in cutting the bamboo. Fortunately, the old villagers always carry these big machetes. And he slowly cut through the bamboo and slowly proceeded to let this monk down. And then piggybacked him down off the hill and to a small hut near his rice fields. And at that point, the monk was losing consciousness and was so sick that he was going in and out of consciousness. The old man put him on a bamboo bench at the hut. At this time, the pig hunter, in those 3 weeks after he'd set his trap, he'd gone off to Bangkok to get a job. And while he was working in Bangkok, he said later on that he became very agitated and restless. He couldn't sleep at night and he didn't know why. And so he, before collecting his wages, he got on a bus and caught the overnight bus back to his home village, put his things down and immediately went up the mountain to check his trap. And he walked past the monk who'd fallen off the cliff and the old man. And he got up the mountain and, of course, he was very shocked at what he saw when he came across this monk who'd been waiting for him for 3 weeks. And he removed the cable and carried the monk off the mountain. It's 8 kilometers down approximately, and he didn't rest once. He was so concerned that this monk survive and he get him to medical attention. But when they came down, they had to pass the other monk with the broken ankle. And when they passed the other monk with the broken ankle, he said, "What happened to you?" And he said, "It's a long story." And this "it's a long story" is another metaphor for papancha. Yes? Have you ever noticed sometimes you sit meditation for an hour and you come out and it's been meditation on a long story? That is what we mean by papancha, where we make the story and add on to the story, the picture in the mind. And what they decided to do was, because these two monks each had broken right ankles, they were going to have treatment there. And they had two benches brought, and they used herbs. They didn't go to the hospital. They used herbs to treat themselves, and these two men, the pig hunter and the old man, looked after them. And it took almost 2 months before they could walk. And the hunter had so much remorse for what he had done that he asked for forgiveness from the monk and asked whether he could become his disciple and whether he could become a monk with him. And the friend who told me this story said the last time he saw the monk was when he walked off with his pig hunter disciple, taking him off to ordain as a monk. Now, that we see is a story, but it points to many things. A thing about the speculation of the mind. When he was stepped off the cliff, he was so focused on trying to help this monk and so caught up in his thoughts about the monk, he didn't see the edge. He didn't see the danger. And sometimes that is often arising in our lives and our minds too, that we are so caught up in the story that we've painted in our mind that it has no relation to reality, or we don't see the dangers that we're getting close to an edge. And that is what happens when papancha gets out of control, isn't it? When the mind speculates, gets caught up in its fears or its anxieties to the point where they become neuroses or even paranoia, and then they become getting close to the edge and falling off the edge. Because we're caught up, we've created a picture that has been motivated by something not necessarily related to what's going on here and now. And we project onto that, what are people thinking about me? What did they mean by that? We try to imagine, interpret, to judge and speculate rather than know. The Buddha's teachings is staying with what you know rather than imagination and speculation, dreams and fantasies. To stay with what you can understand with this mind. To know clearly. To know what's happening. And to know also papancha or speculation as that, the mind adding on to what can be known. And we see this often very clearly with fear. And the reason I'm talking about that is because it's not the only area of papancha or speculation, but it's a very obvious one and clear one. And the reason I mention it is because before coming here to Australia, I took some of the monks from my monastery up on the mountain of the Kauyei National Park. And I'll just correct something that Sol said, because I work very hard. I have 50 monks at my monastery, not 25, so that's 30 more than Ajahn Brom. Buddhist monks like to be factual and tell the truth. And I decided that it would be nice to take a group of them away from the monastery and go into the national parks to have some solitude. And some lay people kindly offered to prepare food for us, travel up onto the mountain. We had to hike up there and stay with us for the week. And these two gentlemen prepared a very simple food and offered it us each morning. And we were living in a very isolated part of the mountain. About it was a 4-hour walk from the edge of the national park, and it was a large river through the national park, and had a large rocky area and forest either side. And we put our mosquito nets and our umbrellas up in the forest there. And this national park has many wild animals. There's, as we're walking in, we saw elephant excrement, we saw bear, a tiger, and a wild pig, tracks and excrement, and also these wild gur, which are very large wild cattle, and a wonderful array of bird life as well. And so it's a very dense population of large animals there, and that was one of the reasons to go there. And having been up on the mountain, it was very interesting when you're sitting in a thin mosquito net and it's getting dark. And the forest rangers have told you the stories of all the tiger attacks on the national park. For example, they came and on previous occasion and told me that one time a monk had been sitting in the national park there, and he was sitting meditation at night with his bowl in front of him in his mosquito net, and this tiger came up and leapt on his bowl, thinking it was a part of him, completely crushing the bowl. But the tiger's claws had got caught in the mosquito net, so it let go and jumped away. And the monk was quite frightened, obviously. And he sat meditation till 12 o'clock at night, until his bowels were about to give out. And he knew he had to go to the toilet. And so he lifted up the mosquito net and shone his torch out to go out into the darkness. And he saw the tiger crouched down 2 meters away, flicking its tail like a cat waiting to pounce on a mouse. And so he decided that that very thin mosquito net was like a wall for him. Psychologically, it was a protection. So he sat all night. He wasn't able to meditate, he said. He could meditate only on the words, "It's going to eat me. It's going to eat me. It's going to eat me." Early in the morning, he saw the tiger was gone. He quickly packed up his bowl, his mosquito net, rushed off the mountains. He met the wardens, the park rangers, and told them what had happened. And then he said, "I think my Achan, my teacher, needs me back at the monastery." So, where we were camped, I went for a walk and checked where one of the other monks, an American monk, was staying. He was about half a kilometer away from me, and right next to his mosquito net, he hadn't noticed there was a very large tree, and there was tiger claw marks on the tree. I tried to stretch as high as I could, and they were about a meter above my outstretched arms. And the claw marks were very sharp, just like a cat scratches and sharpens its claws on a tree. This tiger had ripped a great holes in this bark of a tree. That night, sitting alone in this mosquito net, you see Papancha. Yes. Papancha works in funny ways. The slightest sound, a little rustle in the forest leaves, is suddenly a big tiger. You shine your torch out, sure it's a tiger coming, and you see little mice, little rat run away. The sound of a little rat suddenly becomes the sound of a tiger or an elephant. And one of the things to do with Papancha is to use its energy. So I would walk meditation, thinking, because where we were staying, there was tiger excrement around. You could see the bones of the deer in the excrement. And some of the villagers who'd sent us up the mountain had come across where a tiger had just done a recent kill and the blood was still fresh. So they were there. They could see you, but you couldn't see them. Human eyes are pretty useless in the dark. So that gets Papancha going. And one of the useful things, as I said, is to try and redirect the energy of the mind. So walking meditation on the rocks, we're trained to investigate fear. What's the tiger going to eat? How does a tiger attack? And I had studied biology and animal behavior, so I always took an interest in animal behavior. And I read that tigers normally strike from behind. They like to strike from behind. That is why many people in tiger-infested areas wear a mask on the back of the head. So walking up and down, you're always having to turn your back in one direction or the other. And so you use the imagination of the tiger striking on the back of the head. And then the other thing I read, that the tigers like to eat the abdomen and the intestines, the liver and the heart and the lungs first. So one imagines a tiger eating. My tiger might die of cholesterol because I've... you imagine the tiger eating this body. Then the tiger bites the arms, the legs and the bones. And what I found was the best thing for dropping thoughts about the tiger was just thinking about emptiness. Who is it there? What eats what? When one sees this body is made of elements, earth, fire, air, water, space and consciousness. Six elements there. Sometimes four is described in the words of the Buddha, sometimes six. But the one that was very interesting for breaking through Papancha was the space element, the space in the body. There's emptiness there. What is eating? What? And you find that the mind comes very still and very peaceful. Then, as it gets dark, and go and sit in the mosquito net. Sitting in a very simple mosquito net. And it all seems very wonderful. But then suddenly a branch broke and landed on the roof of the mosquito net. And I jumped. And then I noticed the concern of what if the tiger's coming. But the thing that helped me the most was the thought of this venerable old monk and the snake. If you're going to eat me, you have to take me to enlightenment. And so the mind openly said, if there's any tigers in this Kalye National Park, if you're going to eat this monk, take him to enlightenment. And suddenly the mind became very calm. That is keeping the mind on the goal for a Buddhist. Because whether you die from being eaten by a tiger or collapsing at your desk, you're going to die. It will happen. It's just a matter of when. But if one keeps in the mind when it happens, take this mind to enlightenment. And the way we take this mind to enlightenment is by letting go of all things. Letting go of the world outside, letting go of the body, and even letting go of the mind. And when we let go of all those things, then we do go in that way. And that is the way to make the mind peaceful. And by letting go, making the mind still and calm, then understanding arises, and one sees the danger of papancha, speculation about things. Because however we think it may be, it will be otherwise. Even these blissful states, if we imagine how tranquility will be, if we imagine how samadhi will be, if we imagine how enlightenment will be, will be completely wrong. It will be completely different from how we speculate, how we imagine. So be prepared to be surprised. And that brings me to this story, another story of a monk, speaking to a monk, and he was telling me when he was a young boy, His grandmother took him to a monastery in the northeast of Thailand to see a very famous monk. His name was Lumpu Khao. And Lumpu Khao was a contemporary of Ajahn Chah's. And this young 3-year-old boy went to the monastery with his grandmother, and he was sitting towards the front, and a person had travelled from the south-eastern part of the country and had brought some rambutans. I don't know whether you've seen rambutans in their skin, but they have a very hairy, prickly-looking skin, quite green and red, quite dramatic colours. And this young boy had never, ever seen rambutans before with their skin on. And he was sitting there staring at them as the people offered the monks the meal. This was 8 o'clock in the morning. The monks ate early there. And the old monk, Ajahn Chah, had some of these rambutans in his bowl lid. And he saw this young boy staring at them, fascinated. And so he called him over. And he said, Would you like some rambutans? And the boy said, yes. And he said, I'll swap you. If you sit meditation for me, I'll give you some rambutans. And so he said, cross your right leg on your left, put your right hand on your left, and shut your eyes. And the little boy did so. And then he said, I want you to meditate. And the little boy said, how do I meditate? And he says, it's easy. Just say to yourself over and over again, rambutan, 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 rambutan. And so the little boy sat there, focused his mind on the thing he found so delightful and was interested in, and said, rambutan. Rambutan, rambutan. And he told me after a while his mind went into a place that he said was like another world. There was just bliss and light, and he couldn't feel his body. And there was great happiness there. and it seemed to last not very long. And then after a while he heard a sound of a bell. Dong, dong, dong. And that brought him out of the meditation. And when he opened his eyes, the venerable old monk was sitting there meditating with him. And he looked around and there was no one else in the hall. Everyone had gone. The monks were out sweeping the monastery because it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He had been sitting there from 8 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon because his mind became unified with the Rambutan. So there's some meditation advice in that. I told the story to one of the monks of the monastery and he said, I'm going to go back to my heart and meditate on donuts, donuts, donuts. But the very important aspect of that, which is a very delightful story, but is the fact that people will sometimes ask, how old do you have to be? Can children meditate? You can see that this child had qualities that this old monk recognized. And he was able to keep his mind on an object of delight and interest for a long, long time. And so the trick to be able to sit and experience these peaceful, blissful states is to take deep interest in them, delight in them, to flavor them, to taste them, to enjoy the meditation object with deep, delightful interest, just as the young boy imagined the Rambutan. And if you do that, you take delight in the meditation object, focus your mind on a wholesome object for a long, long, sustained period of time without any papancha, then the mind will experience these deep states of peace. So, may you all experience the delight and happiness of peace, and I hope that I will have the opportunity to meet you all again, and if you're ever traveling through the northeast of Thailand, stay away from cliffs. Is there any questions? Well, the question for those who didn't hear is that some people are afraid of animals, and we talked about that. Some people are afraid of ghosts or spirits, the unseen. Actually, I will even broaden out the question because what I found is many people are afraid of nature as well, or even the unknown. And so how do we deal with that? And one of the traditional ways of dealing, particularly with what is unseen or unknown, one has anxiety about, is to chant. So, for example, developing the loving kindness chant. The chant on loving kindness is a very, very powerful way of calming the mind down first and then spreading out feelings of goodwill. It overcomes anxiety and fear because anxiety and fear is driven by aversion to the unknown. Anxiety about the unknown, the not wanting, the not liking, the experience of not knowing. And so that is overcome by developing goodwill to the present moment, goodwill to the situation, and that brings up a sense of ease and peace. And a lot of people feel anxiety about ghosts or spirits, and that can be overcome by chanting, spreading loving kindness. That is the first way. The other way, that traditional way of overcoming anxiety, is actually to give something to others. So maybe you can't see if there's anything out there, but even if you don't know that, you can offer any acts of goodness that you've done in this life or in a previous life, today or at some other time, to all beings. And may whatever beings they are, may they accept the gifts of all my kindness that I've ever done as an offering. May that being or beings share in the merit that I have done in this lifetime. However great or small, I offer that to other beings. And when we give something to others, it raises the mind up. It brings the mind out of this sense of being powerless, being subjected to the unknown, or subjected to our fears and anxieties, and raises the mind up to being expansive, to opening up and giving, sharing, overcomes hatred and fears. And so that's the second way to overcome fear of the unknown. And I would recommend those two methods. If you don't find those work, then just to sit meditation and do loving kindness meditation. Loving kindness meditation overcomes fear of harm from enemies or from weapons or from other non-human beings or other people. You can see that even the animal realm, creatures in the animal realm, respond to a person with loving kindness. They're attracted to them. Human beings are attracted to them. So why not the non-living realm, the non-human beings? And so it's a natural cause, a natural consequence, that kindness overcomes aversion and overcomes fear as well. I won't tell you any ghost stories because Ajahn Brahma's pitched them all and told you anyway. But my best one is... My best one is actually Ajahn Brahma was at this occasion, so he has the right to tell this story, and he probably has many times, because we were both invited to an invitation at a layperson's house in Bangkok, and we were there, and we were waiting for a doctor friend of theirs to come along, and he didn't turn up, so we had the meal, and then after the meal he came to the house quite flustered and was very apologetic for arriving late, and said to the host and us as well that there's a very strange and unusual event occurred at Sri Rat Hospital, the biggest hospital in Bangkok, and his medical friend, who was a doctor on ward on the evening shift, had been found unconscious in the lift. And when they found him, they took him to intensive care. He came to, and he told the story that at about 2 o'clock in the morning, he was getting into the lift. He pressed the close the door button on the fifth floor. He went down, the lift went down to the third floor, and the lift stopped, doors opened, and a nurse got in the lift. So the doctor closed the doors, pressed the button for the ground floor, the lift went down, stopped on the second floor, and the doors opened, and there was a female patient standing there in her nightgown wanting to get in the lift. And the doctor slammed his hand on the close the door button just as the patient was to step into the lift, and the door was shut, and he went very pale and started to shake. And the nurse asked, "Why did you do that, doctor? Couldn't you see the patient wants to get into the lift?" And he turned to the nurse and said, "That was one of my patients. She died this evening. I sent her corpse down to the morgue." And the nurse said, "You must have been mistaken. She was standing right there. Obviously you've made a mistake." And he said, "No, no. Didn't you see? She had a red plastic name tag on her wrist. We put them on all the corpses, all the people who die. And the nurse stood there looking shocked and then raised her hand up and showed the red plastic name tag on her wrist and said, "Does that mean I'm dead too?" And at that point, the doctor collapsed. There was a ghost outside and a ghost inside, and no escape. And the only regret I have about my visit to this center is we don't have a lift for you to return home in. Because I always tell people, when you get in the lift, check the wrist. But the interesting part of that story was his friend, when he heard his doctor friend describe what had happened, went down to the morgue. And he said, yes, there was a lady who fitted his description, who had been on that ward that he was running and had died that very night. And he had signed off the death certificate. And right next to her body in the refrigerator was the body of a nurse who worked in the hospital, and she was supposed to be on shift that night as well, and she had a motorcycle accident on the way to work. So, don't be too concerned about getting to work on time. You don't get paid overtime if you're dead. It's supposed to be absolutely true story. Ajahn Brahm can vouch for it. He was there.